Today is June 27th, 1977, and I'm talking with Commander R.F. Choate, who served with the Royal Canadian Navy. Commander Choate, would you give us a brief account of your family background?
Certainly. I was born in Maple Bay, near Duncan, Vancouver Island, on June 1924. The youngest of three children, with one elder brother and one elder sister. Father was Australian and served with the Anzacs during the First World War, being wounded at Gallipoli and being taken to England for hospitalization, where he met and fell in love with his nurse, who was my mother. They were married in England and were on their way to Australia via Canada in 1922, when they decided that, having got as far as Vancouver Island, that is where they'd rather settle and spend the rest of their life. I was born there in 1924. Had lived in and around Maple Bay until 1936, when the family as a whole went over to England to visit aunts and uncles, relations, and other members of my mother's family, and ended up by being stuck there during the start of the Second World War. I completed my schooling in England, having started initially in Maple Bay, and then going to school in Duncan until the time we went to England. In England, I attended two different schools, both by North American standards, private schools, but although known as public schools in England. I completed my schooling at the age of 17 and a half, at which stage I joined the Royal Navy as an ordinary seaman.
This was in 1939 you joined as an ordinary seaman?
No. If you remember, I'd said had gone over to England and were stuck in England at the start of the war. It was our intention, or the family's intention, to return to Canada. And we initially had a passage from England to Canada in 1939 in the late summer, which was cancelled. With the immediate prospect of war breaking out in Europe, and eventually obtained a passage to Canada in 1940. However, the ship we were on, the City of Benares, was sunk some 700 miles off the coast of Ireland on our way to Canada, and the family was picked up eventually by a British destroyer and returned to England, at which stage I returned to school, as I was still then at about 16, and joined the Navy initially in 1942.
As an ordinary seaman?
As an ordinary seaman.
What was your motivation to join the Navy? Why the Navy?
Well, that goes back quite a number of years. My initial interest in the Navy had started at the age of something before 10 in Maple Bay, when the Canadian Navy invariably sent two destroyers up into Maple Bay area during the summer for a period of a week or 10 days. And I happened to be on the beach one day as a youngster, I suppose probably about 8 or 9, and was invited out to one of the destroyers by one of the sailors, and I went with him and spent the day in the destroyer, and from that time on my mind was essentially made up that what I'd like was the Navy as a career. Mind you, at that stage I was far too young. When we went to England in 1935 or 36, I did have the intention, if possible, of going into Dartmouth. and joining the Royal Navy as a midshipman. But with my schooling that I'd done at that stage in Canada, and the difference of the entry exams in Dartmouth, I ruled that out and decided that I would just do the normal schooling. However, later when we had planned to come to Canada, it was known at that stage that the Naval College, or a form of Naval College, was to open in Canada in either late 1940 or early 41. And I'd been lucky enough through some connections that Mother had, and I don't know who they were, to get a sponsorship from Mr. Vincent Massey, who was then the High Commissioner for Canada in London, to the Naval College when it did open. Naturally, not arriving back in Canada in 1940 after the ship was torpedoed, I had to reassess those plans and decided that at that stage, probably the best method for me to get into the Navy was via what they then called the special entry into Dartmouth, which was an area where they took a number of young men at the age of approximately 17, 17 and a half, in for a much shorter period than a normal Dartmouth training period, but ended up the same being commissioned as midshipmen in the Royal Navy. Again, that fell foul of the fact that the school I was at then misinterpreted the syllabus for the exams, and I discovered some matter of 2 weeks prior to actually sitting the exam that physics was a required subject, and I had not been studying physics. And bearing in mind that the exams for that special entry to Dartmouth were highly competitive, there was no point in even thinking of trying to bring physics from the zero level to that type of level in a matter of 2 weeks. So at that stage, being relatively close to the official call-up age of the British forces, or for British people living in England at the time, I decided that better to volunteer and join the Navy of my own free will, as I'd always wanted to do, rather than wait for my actual call-up papers and then maybe just get sent into the Air Force or Army, wherever they needed people most. And so the actual moment of joining, a motivation, I suppose, was to ensure that I got into the Navy, as opposed to the other two services, because I'd always been interested in that from the, say, the age of about 9. And I suppose at that stage, too, half hoping that ultimately I could obtain a transfer from the wartime-only type of service to the peacetime navies when peace returned to the continent or to the navies of the world. And as it happened, that is exactly as it transpired.
So you served as a year, served for a year as a seaman?
I served for about a year as an ordinary seaman and did my initial training in the Royal Navy New Entry Training Base outside Plymouth, or in actual fact in Cornwall, just across the river from Plymouth, in an establishment known as HMS Raleigh, in Tor Point, Cornwall. And I can't remember exactly how long the training periods were there. I, to best of my recollection now, to be in the region of 8 weeks, which was absolutely basic recruit training, very, very minimal seamanship, some drill, some weapons work, but very limited. And then was posted to the Manning Depot in Devonport, just outside Plymouth, for a further assignment, and was, after a matter of some 2 weeks there, with further kitting out and further sort of basic instruction, was drafted or posted to a small coastal patrol sloop working out of Harwich in England by the name of HMS Guillemot. And as an aside, which is somewhat interesting, I suppose, that the first lieutenant, or the executive officer of HMS Guillemot at that time, was a gentleman by the name of Nicholas Montserrat, who later became very well known for a number of books he wrote, I suppose probably best known for The Cruel Sea.
Mm-hmm.
I spent some 9 months in that particular vessel and was selected by the captain, I presume from the captain and from the other officers, as what they termed then a CW candidate, candidate for commission rank. And with them having made that selection and having put the papers through, in due course I was posted or drafted to the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve Officers Training Establishment in Brighton, England, in about the middle of 1943, and be somewhere in June or July of 43. It in fact had two establishments. The initial part of the training, some 4 weeks, was in what it used to be, or what had been in previous times, a girls' school, which the Royal Navy had taken over as their training establishment. And then the latter part was done right in Brighton itself, based around the old amusement pier that again had been taken over by the services in Brighton. And this particular course lasted about 3 months and was the really the Royal Navy volunteer equivalent of what the Americans, and I think the Americans termed the phrase, the 90-day wonder. The course was approximately 3 months, and again went into a certain amount of drill, but essentially seamanship, navigation, small boat handling, and theoretically enough background information that you could go to a different type of ship as a young officer and have enough basis to do from there on-the-job training on the bridge of a ship. The vast majority of people who went through that establishment, known as HMS King Alfred, ended up being posted to coastal forces for assault landing craft or combined operations, or to coastal forces in the MTBs, Fairmiles, that type of craft, very small coastal craft. I happened to one of, I suppose, really quite few, if I remember correctly, something in the region of about 8 out of our course that was selected to go on to larger type ships as a midshipman, and went from there to the Royal Naval College at Greenwich for a matter of 3 weeks, what one would call, in this day and age, I suppose, a knife and fork school, to ensure that these young wartime officers, that when they, if they did go to a destroyer, would have sufficient social graces to fit into the wardroom well. And on completion of that, I was then appointed to Her Majesty's ship Stork, which was then known as a bird-class sloop, and currently at that stage working in the Atlantic.
How large was the class of officers, midshipmen that were training? You said 8 were selected to go to larger ships.
That's making me go back in memory a long time. I would say somewhere between 90 and 100. Of which the attrition rate was reasonably high. I would say of the 90 or so that started, probably something in the order of only 60 to 65 eventually graduated. Although before being selected for this course as a CW candidate, you had to certainly have a minimum education. The information on navigation and seamanship and things like that was thrown to you pretty quickly. And I think I was lucky in that, having spent most of my youth in Maple Bay in and around the small boats, I had a ready knack in seamanship and boat handling, and navigation and that sort of type of instruction we got seemed to come very easily to me. But a number of the youngsters who certainly had come from other walks of life that were far from the sea had a fair amount of difficulty with it, and the attrition rate was quite high. So the graduating group, I would say something probably in the region of about 65.
They would fail because they couldn't pass the exams, or
either not meeting the standard of the exams and just straight passing the exams, a number for conduct. They started right from the word go, and assuming that your conduct would be that of an officer and gentleman, to use rather a trite phrase. We did our training still in a sailor's uniform, and on graduation you were issued, if I remember correctly, the sum, I think it was £10, with which you were then were to go and buy yourself your officer's uniform. A number of people also, after having started off in the course, requested to be taken off at their own wish and to go back to whatever they were doing before in the way of being a young seaman or whatever their trade was in the Navy beforehand. Having decided fairly quickly in the course that being a naval officer as opposed to being just in the Navy was not exactly their cup of tea. I don't suppose I really worked any harder than a great deal of the other people, but again, it's something I'd always wanted to do, was have a commission in the Navy and be an officer in one of the naval ships. And that certainly gave me an incentive.
Mm-hmm. At the Knife and Forks, well, I'm not aware that the Army or the Air Force didn't have similar schools, whereas I know that the Navy did. What sort of, is that true, and what sort of things did they teach you other than Knife and Forks?
Well, I can't say it was really true. I suspect it is true that the Navy was probably the only one that did a form of this. And it was essentially a naval history, general sort of naval strategy, matters of naval interest, but one was put through a very rigorous parade type of training from the point of view of establishing a bearing and a deportment, and the meals and things like that, even in the really the height of wartime England in 1943, were done with an absolutely full tradition and decorum in the Royal Naval College at Greenwich. And I think more to instill in a young officer, even though he was a reserve officer at that stage, the tradition and the history and things behind the service that he was now part of as an officer.
Then, so you went to the Stork, and when did you first become involved with the combined operations, which eventually led to the action in D-Day?
Well, I was in the Stork from about mid, well, I suppose late summer, 73, and stayed with her and got at that stage my watchkeeping certificate, which was a matter of just putting in time on the bridge of the ship and standing watches as an officer and learning by experience on the job until the captain or the commanding officer was satisfied that he could leave you on the bridge yourself and that you had sufficient knowledge to take all the necessary emergency action that might be required of you to face any eventuality that came up while you might be on watch. And as you may, well, as I'm sure you know, the officer of the watch in a ship is the captain's representative on the bridge. He runs the ship, keeps her out of all danger, takes any necessary action to counteract any emergency situation that may arise while he's on watch, until such time as the captain himself can get to the bridge from wherever he is, either be it asleep or elsewhere in the ship, and take more positive action himself. Because in wartime, it meant the rudimentary ability to do a rapid counterattack on a submarine, bring the weapons into action, if necessary, against aircraft or any surface craft, to maintain station on the convoy without either losing the convoy or losing yourself or colliding with any of the ships in the convoy, and running the general routine of the ship. I got my watchkeeping certificate from the commanding officer of Stork in, I suppose, probably in about January or February of 44. And we had been, up until that time, running from Gibraltar, or correction, from Liverpool, usually around the north of Ireland to Gibraltar, and then from Gibraltar to Freetown in northwest Africa, back to Gibraltar, through the Mediterranean to Alexandria or Port Said, back to Gibraltar, and then back to Liverpool, and would continue that type of run. And so it gave a fair wide range of experience from the rather bad, foggy, rainy, heavy weather of the North Atlantic to the rather attractive weather of the northwest African coast, to the range of submarines in the Atlantic, to some air opposition and lighter submarine opposition off the African coast, and back into the Mediterranean with a fair amount of air opposition and submarine opposition to our convoys. Although never at that stage did we ever get into any surface actions with the Italian fleet or any of the other ships, enemy ships that might have been there. Our role was always as the convoy escort, the close escort and close protection of the convoy. Most action against enemy surface shipping was done by the larger units of the fleet that normally stood off at some distance between the convoys and the enemy bases. And having got my ticket, and watchkeeping ticket, that is, and being back in England in approximately April of 1944, the combined operations forces were really starting to gear up for the planned assault on Northern Europe, and the numbers of assault craft, landing craft, and that generally the assault craft were building up, and they were starting to collect or put together a much larger team of people to man these craft. And I was posted from Stork to combined operations craft, and within a month of, well, even closer to that, I would say by very close to mid-April in 44, you must remember, of course, that I was extremely as happy as one can be in a wartime situation. I enjoyed the ship I was in. But the Royal Navy, even in wartime, and even with reserve officers, would frequently give consideration, as much as they could, to your own personal wishes of where you should go, what type of ship you'd serve in, and if you could, even a theater of operations. On the posting to the combined operations, I, however, was not consulted on that. I was quietly told that that is what I was going to do for a number of months, and was posted to a rather strange craft. If I remember correctly, she was a P&O liner, probably in the bracket, I'm thinking back, in the vicinity of 18 to 20,000 tons, known as the Langibby Castle. And she carried some 18, or had been adapted to carry, some 18 of the small LCAs, assault landing craft, at Davits. With the object being that she would be a mothership and carry troops, and on arriving in whatever an assault was planned, the troops would load in the craft and be lowered, and then the craft would always take off and take the troops in and land them wherever they had planned to be landed. If the weather was ideal, the craft from the lower tiers were normally loaded at deck level and lowered. If the weather was not good and the parent ship was rolling at all, the craft were normally lowered and the troops had to scramble down, scramble nets or ladders, what have you, into them and man them when they were in the water. We spent from the time I joined until the very early part of June in 44, almost in continual rehearsal on various beaches, various exercises to get to know our troops that we were going to be working with, and for them to get to know us and get as quick as possible in loading the craft and unloading them and getting off them, and for us ourselves to get used to handling these craft and to learn certain basic procedures and the way the craft would assemble after loading the troops. I can't remember at this stage. The Americans had certainly started some of their combined operations in the Pacific by this stage, but I don't think a great deal of the doctrine had come back over to the Royal Navy by then. I think we were still using very much the sort of tactics and the theories on this that the RN had developed themselves, as a result, of course, of raids of Dieppe and things like that, which they had given themselves or earned some experience in.
What about the intelligence that was gathered on the landing? You mentioned that there was you were given a panoramic photograph of the beach.
Yes. This is, I think, the thing that impressed me most of all. And we were given, as you've mentioned, a mosaic of photographs that had been taken of certainly the beach that we had to land on, and I would assume to across all the landing craft and to and all the various areas that they were to land. And these photographs, I assume, had been mainly taken from very low-flying aircraft, but I suppose it's entirely possible that number were taken as well from midget submarines or from swimmers. They were all certainly very low level and gave you the complete shoreline and skyline of any buildings behind the shoreline, very much as you would see them from a craft. And we, in actual fact, were given a particular building in front of which we should land. And if we did that, we knew we got our troops down in the spot where they were meant to be, and which one, of course, hoped to do, because their plans for clearing the beach and rendezvous later on in behind the beach would be based on a known starting position. And if we dropped them, I suppose, far from where they thought they were going to have landed, they might well have trouble identifying and finding their various rendezvous spots. As it happened, I think we dropped ours exactly on target, and certainly within minutes of the planned time. And this was from a run, again from memory, I would say some 8 to even 10 miles off the coast, where the major ships of the size of Langkawi Castle anchored, and the troops were landed into the barges and taken in from there.
Now, your specific task was to act as the officer who put one barge in place and the rest would take their place from your barge?
Yes. We go back a step, that I was posted to this salt landing craft flotilla as a navigator and boats officer, and although never specified as such, certainly understood as a sort of seamanship officer. It was a marine flotilla, a Royal Marine flotilla of craft. And as you're aware, I'm sure the Royal Marines have always had a history of being at sea and taking part in things naval, and again in the assault business and the command operations. They had taken over a number of these flotillas, of which I was attached to one of them as the navigator and, I say, as the boats officer and a seamanship officer. It so happened to complete the mix that this was a young naval officer in a Royal Marine flotilla of craft, and we were handling and loading and unloading Canadian troops. But as a navigator, it is my responsibility as the... Well, go back one step again. Of the 18 craft we had, there were 3 flights of 6. And our 18 craft were spread on landing reasonably evenly across the beach in a group of 6, group of 6, and a group of 6. And my craft was the nearest the middle of the middle group of 6, which the others essentially kept station on going into the beach, both for timing and for direction and where to land. And we anticipated really little problem in this, in view of the, as you say, the intelligence and the photographs we had been given, which we felt would make it very easy for us to identify the exact area where we should land. The only hazard in that is whether the particular buildings would have been blown out in a pre-bombardment, either by ship or by air, or by rocket craft. As it happened, it wasn't. And the particular hotel that we were due to land opposite was there, might well have been damaged, but it was certainly there and recognizable, and which we landed right in front of it.
What you mentioned that you were transporting Canadian units, I believe one of them was the Winnipeg Rifles? Or?
Well, I mentioned that to you earlier, and going back in memory, I am pretty sure it was the Winnipeg Rifles, although thinking over this since we last spoke, I couldn't really get clear in my mind whether it really was the Winnipeg Rifles, or whether, because I had read so frequently in the past that the Winnipeg Rifles were there, that was a thing put into my mind. But I'm reasonably sure it was. There were certainly Canadian troops, and our landing was opposite right in the middle of a little village called Seul-sur-Mer.
What was the identification of your flotilla? Did it have, like, say, the 18th flotilla or whatever?
Well, having kindly given me a moment to look up some records, it was the 557th Landing Craft Flotilla of the Royal Marines. And going back to my records, I officially joined them on the 14th of April, 44, so I wasn't far out in my original date, and I stayed with them until the 30th of July, 1944.
What, you mentioned the naval bombardment. Could you elaborate a little on what it consisted of as you saw it?
The overall plan, as I remember it, and bearing in mind that I was an extremely small cog in a very large wheel at that stage, was an initial massive air attack on the beaches and the ground in behind the beaches to try and keep the, or get the enemy out of that area, or at least subdue them considerably, coupled from, and again this is right from memory, probably some half hour to three quarters of an hour before the actual landing, a massive sea bombardment, essentially by cruisers and the number of battleships, and they were all standing offshore quite some considerable distance, 8 to 9 miles, and carrying out a typical naval bombardment of a shore area. Each would have had specific targets, and with assistance of air spotters, and probably pinpointing in as much as possible on various known enemy concentration areas or pillboxes or fixed defensive positions to try and obliterate those, or at least make the enemy keep their heads down. The air attack was frequently known, I believe, in those days as sort of as a creeping attack. It would start right from the beach and work inland a little. The naval bombardment, to the best of my knowledge, stayed pretty much on the beach and the area immediately behind the beach, and timed to stop literally some seconds prior to the first troops actually landing on the beach. This was a mixture of battleships and cruisers. Most of our Navy cruisers were at that stage using 8-inch guns, the battleships anything up to 15-inch guns. Destroyers would be in closer and with more specific shore line targets to work on. And there were a number of landing craft, not unlike the assault landing craft that I was in, that had been converted into a form of rocket-firing craft with a large number of spigots fitted inside the craft, each with a little type of mortar bomb of a fixed range, and what they were known then as ripple firing. In other words, they each line went off separately and it ripple fired throughout the craft, so that as the craft moved into the beach at a fairly steady speed, it spread the bombs over an area. The only way of aiming the bombs was to aim the craft. And I suppose one amusing anecdote was that shortly after the landing, we had one of these craft come back alongside our parent ship, and it was commanded by a young sub-lieutenant of the Royal New Zealand Navy Volunteer Reserve, who was broken-hearted and distraught, and once one was able to get out of him what his problem was, it is that he had done something like a year's training in New Zealand, had come over to England, and had spent further months training for this particular role, had taken his craft all the way across the channel for this particular target, and to the best of his knowledge, he'd missed. And in that particular type of craft, it is a one-shot effort.
Right.
You hit or you missed, and he, in his estimation, he had missed. And felt this was not only a terrible disgrace, but a sort of terrible waste of time that he'd spent in all this preparation for it. The one thing that did astound me in retrospect was the weather conditions in which the a number of these very small craft made it across the channel. I'm sure you've heard from other people that the actual landing was delayed 24 hours, which was a massive undertaking on its own, because we, in actual fact, had started on the evening of the 4th of June and were some miles into the channel. And being a reasonably fast craft, we were one of the later ones to sail. This is the parent craft who carried the assault craft. But a vast number of the Armada were all underway and were recalled because of the weather when D-Day was delayed by 24 hours. And to get all those craft back and get them reorganized and reassembled to start again 24 hours later, still in very marginal weather, certainly as far as we were concerned, and to the best of my knowledge, virtually all of them got there. There must have been, I'm sure there must have been some of the smaller ones lost on the way across the channel, either from being swamped and sinking or various other things. But even on the morning when we arrived on the 6th of June, the weather was far from ideal. Still, from this, and bearing in mind that we were running pretty small craft, I couldn't even remember the dimensions of them now. I would say that they were probably in the region of 35 to 40 feet long by about 8 feet wide, and a freeboard of something in the order of probably 2.5 feet, which was heavily armored, and then a ramp in the front of the boat that, as you hit the beach, could be lowered for the troops to just run out of the front of the craft. The troops were all carried kneeling or sitting behind the side of the craft and to a degree protected. The person who was reasonably exposed in the craft was the, although he had some protection too, was the coxswain of the craft who actually did the steering. As far as probably the most vulnerable position in the whole craft was the young laddie who was assigned as the engineer. He would have to sit right in between two large Ford V8 engines, and was in the most vulnerable position, generally speaking, from the point of view of mines or things like that. And if a mine went off underneath the craft, you could expect the engines to come adrift, and this poor lad would be left sitting with a V8 engine in his lap. And certainly the young stokers of those craft, because of the beach mines and the limpet mines on their beach obstacles, I think had a very high percentage of the casualties, and it took a lot of courage, I think, to be in that role where you couldn't see what was going on, you couldn't see anything that was happening, but sit there with a certain amount of faith in the coxswain, because again, the craft weren't commanded by officers. There was an officer in each flight of six, but the craft individually were commanded by a corporal, or in some cases a lance corporal of Marines. And which brings us back, because I had mentioned to you before, the value of training, in that these youngsters were not navigators or seamen. Well, they've been given pretty concentrated training in handling these craft and maneuvering them, and did really remarkably well. But the value of training came in that having been drilled well in it, that when the chips were down, they still functioned remarkably well and did all the things they had been taught to do. And I'm sure by conditioned reaction, as much by conscious logical thought as to about how they're going to maneuver this craft.
Your craft was hit by a shell.
Yes. We lost, either on the way in or when the craft were withdrawing from the beach, something in the order of, I think, 13 or 14 out of our 18 craft. My own one was hit, I would say, by probably a 20 millimeter or 40 millimeter shell, some 100 or so yards off the beach, which punctured it, knocked a small hole in it just in the bow, just about where the ramp hinged with the main hull. And of course, with the craft moving ahead through the water towards the beach, this effectively forced water into this hole more quickly than it would normally come. And the craft just slowly started to sink, and in fact sank some 20-30 yards off the beach, but in shallow enough water that all the troops we had in that particular craft got ashore. And to the best of my knowledge, I think all our craft landed their troops, not necessarily on the beach, but close enough to the beach that I think they were able to get most of them get a footing and get ashore. A lot of the craft were damaged on withdrawing from the beach and hitting a mine as they came back, or by being broached on the beach and being left as derelicts, where the there's just no way of getting the craft off the beach under its own power. Some of them were recovered a few days later when the beach had cleared and a more normal type of operation could go on, where bulldozers came along and just pushed a number of craft that had been stranded high on the beach back into the water and beyond sand and the engines and things like that. Were put back into service fairly quickly.